Speaking on the program at this time is Brother James W. Boyd.
To try to take the time tonight to refute all of the false ideas that arise from Revelation 20, because we could do that over an extended time. I don't believe I could accomplish that in one or even two nights of all the false ideas. But we could explode all the false doctrines that have been raised out of Revelation 20 and still not know what it does say. Now, usually when we come to discuss this chapter, we will try to point out things that it does not teach because of the widespread, widely accepted theory, speculative theory concerning the second coming of Christ, a literal 1,000 years reign, and all of that sort of thing. There are so many fallacies of that particular theory, we would exhaust considerable time again in showing how in so many places it contradicts what the Word of God does say, particularly with respect to the establishment and the existence of the kingdom, which premillennialists say has not yet taken place. But of course, the Old Testament prophesies the coming of the kingdom, and those prophecies were fulfilled, and the accomplishment of those prophecies in Acts chapter 2 was with the coming of the Lord's church, the Lord himself, as well as the Apostle Paul, showing the kingdom and the church to be one and the same. So I know that the theory of premillennialism is false. We have to keep two or three things in mind as we come to Revelation 20. Keep in mind the overall thrust and theme of the book, which is, as we've often mentioned, spiritual victory belongs to those who are faithful in Christ. And this chapter, like all the others, must be interpreted, the meaning of it must be determined in light of that theme, because all of the previous chapters, all of the previous emphasis has been to underscore that point. Keep in mind, too, as we began in chapter 19, after a number of chapters that had certain repetitive information presented in it about the persecution, about the hardships of the early church, about the eventual destruction of the enemy, and it pointing to the idea of giving hope and encouragement to the battered and bruised Christians, we come with chapter 19 beginning to see a victory celebration. We see that the things that God had told the early Christians were surely going to come to pass. There was certainty in it. They would be victorious. Though they would even be martyred for the cause of Christ, though that would be an apparent defeat, there would not be defeat, not of them personally, nor of the cause for which they died. Chapter 20 is right in the midst of this great victory celebration. Now keep in mind too, and this is a point that we all recognize, that throughout the book of Revelation there has been just host upon host of figurative, symbolic expressions, not literal, actual expressions, things that represent something else. John began the book by telling him of certain things that had been signified unto him. These were signs of things that were to come. Not the actual literal things, not actual literal beasts, not actual literal horses and all of that. These were symbols of ideas and of things that were to shortly come to pass upon the early church. That does not change in chapter 20. In fact, if we count correctly, chapters 19 and 20, there are approximately 20 specifically mentioned symbols. And it is rather inconsistent and certainly incompatible with good exegesis to lift one symbol, a 1,000 years reign, out of all of the midst of these other quite obvious symbols and say it actually refers to a 1,000 years reign. The 1,000 years reign that is mentioned here is a symbol as well as the other things that are symbols. Now let's look at this passage, and I hope that we'll have the time to get through chapter 20 tonight, and Lord willing, about two more nights, we should be able to complete our study on this book. And I saw an angel come down from heaven having the key of the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. This would seem to refer to one of authority. The idea of a key refers to authority. Brother Turner's made that quite plain upon me this week. They had to change a lock back there, and the key I had wouldn't work. When that did work, I had authority to get in there. Now they changed the lock, I guess it won't keep me out. But he gave me another key. Now I've got authority again. I can get back in there and get my mate. That's the idea of a key. A key gives authority. Here comes one of authority. He has authority over this pit. As to what would come in, what would go out, what would happen. And he had a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years. Now the dragon has been used already in the book of Revelation to symbolize a servant of the devil in the personage of the emperor that would instigate so much of this person. The devil, Satan, is a spiritual being. And therefore I know that that which is the chain in the hand of the one of authority is not a literal chain. And who ever heard of a bottomless pit? Other than my sons, as I was trying to feed them as they were growing up, there hasn't existed such things as a bottomless pit. That's obviously, I knew you'd get to that. Right? But there's obviously symbolism here. The one with a key. The bottomless pit. The chain. A spiritual being being bound. How would you take a literal chain and bind a spirit? Are you sitting off? There is no way for the spiritual creature, the devil, to be bound except by the application of the gospel of Jesus Christ. This one with the key had the power of the gospel, and with it would bind Satan. And would, the binding simply means to restrict him. He would be curtailed. He would be prevented from accomplishing what he hoped to accomplish. Now, what had he hoped to accomplish? Through these persecutors, the devil had hoped to accomplish the destruction of the kingdom of God, the Lord's church. Here we learn that deity was not going to permit that to happen. Deity had the authority and the power to so restrict Satan that he could not accomplish it, would bind him for 1,000 years. Now let's notice, 1,000 years, this may sound odd to you, but does not have reference to a time period at all. It is a symbol of completeness, wholeness, fullness. Deity would so restrict Satan and bind him and prevent him and restrict him from the destruction of the church by the persecution that he was instigating there in the first century, and it would be a complete restriction to the prevention of the destruction of the church. The devil sought to destroy. The Lord saw fit to see to it completely that such would not take place. Now it is not uncommon for the Lord to use the terms 1,000 and 1,000 years, 1,000 generations, and such as that, as symbolic to mean complete. I want you, and those of you who have your Old Testament, to turn back with me for a moment to the book of Deuteronomy and chapter 7 and verse 9. And I cite this to you as another one of the instances in the Old Testament where we see certain words and symbols being used to convey ideas that we can intelligently and consistently apply as we strive to find the meaning of Revelation. Now notice in Deuteronomy 7 and verse 9, "Know therefore that the Lord thy God, He is God, the faithful God, which keepeth covenant and mercy with them that love Him and keep His commandments to 1,000 generations. 1,000 generations does not refer to a time period. It's generally thought that a generation would be something like 33, 35, maybe in some estimates 40 years. 1,000 generations would be 35, 40,000 years. Well, if he's going to keep his covenant for 1,000 generations, does this mean that after the 1,000 generations, he wouldn't keep his covenant? If you go up and say to somebody, now, I'm going to do this until such and such a time, and I'll do this for 30 days, that means after 30 days, you don't necessarily obligate yourself to do it anymore. God doesn't have any limitations of time upon keeping his covenant. Obviously, the term 1,000 generations, 1,000 years, this is a symbolism of completeness. God will completely keep his covenant. We count on that. God is faithful. He is dependable. And this expression, 1,000 generations, shows the completeness that God will keep his covenant. So the phrase here, 1,000 years, shows the completeness of the determination of deity to so restrict Satan that he could not and would not destroy the church that he had set out to destroy. That's the idea here behind 1,000 years, I suggest to you. Now notice, and he cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal over him, upon him, that he should deceive the nations no more till 1,000 years should be fulfilled. After that, he would be loosed a little season. There's still that no reference to time. Satan would be completely prohibited and restricted from destroying the church. Now let that sink in. For that was a word of hope to them, and that's a word of assurance to us. Satan will not be permitted to destroy the church of the Lord. Nonetheless, he will continue to have some influence. He will continue to have power. He will continue to seek in his operations. But he will never, ever be completely successful in the destruction of that which God has brought into being. It just won't happen. And that certainly should be motivation for us to want to be a part of that which was going to endure, regardless come what may. But now, he would be bound till 1,000 years should be fulfilled, until it was quite evident that Satan could not destroy the kingdom, and then he would be loosed in the idea that his restrictions, he was never totally restricted. He was never totally wiped out. He wasn't totally destroyed, not at this point. But he was prohibited from the destruction of the church that he set out to do, but his influence and destructive power, to a limited degree, would continue, does even now. And he speaks of this a little further on in this chapter. Now notice what else he saw. He saw here a victory scene. And I saw thrones. Here are those sitting upon thrones. And they sat upon them, and judgment was given unto them. And I saw the souls of them that were beheaded for the witness of Jesus and for the word of God, which had not worshipped the beast, neither his image, neither had received his mark upon their foreheads or in their hands. And they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. And I just have to say this in passing. I'm not going to try to refute all the false ideas that come along and people say, oh, we're going to live and reign with Christ 1,000 years. This chapter doesn't say one thing about us reigning with anybody. Have you been martyred for the cause of Christ? Are you beheaded souls? Are you souls that we read about before that were under the altar crying, how long, how long? Certainly not. It doesn't say anything about you, Brother Watt. I'm sorry. You're not going to reign with anybody according to this. At least not from this. Nor I. Nor any of the rest of us. It doesn't say a thing about this generation. It is talking about those who had been martyred for the cause of Christ. Those who took death rather than to receive the mark of the beast, rather than to bow themselves before the emperor, rather than to succumb to emperor worship, rather than to allow themselves to be branded as a traitor to Christ. They died rather than do that. But where are they now? Now we've seen them once crying, how long? Wondering when God's vengeance was going to be set forth. We see them a little bit later on being assured it was going to take place. We have seen words of where God said it is certain to come. Now we see a scene of them. Where are they? They are as kings. They are as having judgment over others. They had been exalted. The ones who had been martyred, had they lost? Oh, they'd lost their lives. But had they lost? Look at the symbolism here that pictures their great victory in spite of their losses here upon this earth. And they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. A complete victory on their part. 1,000 years doesn't refer to 1,365 plus leap years that might be in there. Doesn't refer to that at all. It talks about the completeness of whatever the subject under consideration. Here, their victory is complete. Right above it, the prevention of Satan from destroying the church was complete. But here, they would live and reign. This doesn't talk about the reign of Jesus. This is talking about the exaltation of martyred saints who died for the cause of Christ, being in fellowship with deity, with spiritual complete victory. That's what I think it means, and not everybody agrees with that, but, you know, some of us got it and some of us haven't. You know how that is. No, that's what I suggest to you, that this thrust of this passage is right here. It's showing. You see, Christian, you are really taking a bashing and beating. Hold on. I'm telling you what's ahead. Just look here. Look what's ahead. Now that's to encourage them. That's to motivate them. But don't give up. All right, let's continue. But the rest of the dead, we'll find out who they are in a minute. The rest of the dead lived not again until the 1,000 years were finished. Until this complete restriction of Satan from destroying the church was accomplished, the rest of the dead. Now that's a real hard one. There's been a lot of real hard ones, hasn't there? I personally have wrestled with this. Who are the rest of the dead? Well, whoever the rest of the dead are, lives not again. Well, back in the Old Testament again, in Isaiah 26, 13 and 14, it speaks of wicked people who live not again, which showed that when they were suppressed and destroyed, they stayed destroyed. Now, that was what was going to come to the persecutors. When the Judaistic system was finally wiped away, literally, physically, destruction of the city of Jerusalem and the complete abolition of the Judaistic system, the impossibility of ever it being resurrected as it had been given. When that happened, it happened completely and forever and was done. When the Roman Empire fell, it fell and it's gone. I suggest to you this phrase, the rest of the dead that live not at all, is almost parallel to that passage in Isaiah which speaks of the wicked who died and would not live again because of their total destruction, being enemies of God. The rest of the dead is simply saying, these persecutors, dear Christian, these persecutors won't be like you. You've been exalted to thrones. What about them? They will perish and will completely perish. Your enemies will be completely destroyed. They won't live again. Now, what does he call all of this? What does he call this exaltation of the faithful Christian, the total destruction of the persecutors? He says it's the first resurrection. The end of the verse. It's like being raised from the dead. How glorious is a resurrection? Well, we read of several resurrections, don't we? I'm talking about literal resurrection. The most prominent of which in our mind is the resurrection of Jesus Christ. How glorious a thing was that? What an awesome, tragic situation in which we would find ourselves if He had died, been buried, and had not been raised from the dead. But to the glory of Him and to the hope of mankind, He was raised. It's a way to adequately express the glory of a resurrection. And the term resurrection has been used in Old Testament and in New Testament to picture marvelous things that would happen. For instance, in the book of Ezekiel. Somebody remember that song Ezekiel connected to Dry Bones. Remember that? Yeah. I'm not the only one who knows that song, am I? I don't know the words of it. You know, the foot bone connected to the ankle bone connected to the leg bone. You've heard that song. And they sing it about like that, only in tune, and man, it's a jumper. But anyway, it's a good song. At least I like to hear it. Ezekiel wrote about that, and what was he talking about? He was talking about the raising up of Israel out of bondage that would go back to Judah, back to their homeland. And he's shown it was like that which had died had been raised again. Figurative use of the idea of resurrection. In the book of Romans, when the Apostle Paul was bereaved over the fact that Jewish brethren were repudiating Christ, and he said, brethren, my heart's desire is that they would be saved. And he went on to express that if they were saved, the Gentile now having the gospel brought to them and receiving it, oh, if my Jewish brethren would receive it, it would be like a resurrection. Now, there wouldn't be a literal resurrection of the Jewish people. It was like the glory of a resurrection. That's what he's saying here about the victory of the early church, overcoming the persecution and the destruction of the persecutors. Their victory, the Christian's victory, the persecutor's defeat, the resurrection of a cause that seemed like and was attempted to have been totally suppressed and wiped out. God says it won't happen. I won't let it happen. I will completely prohibit it from happening. They will be punished. You will be exalted. It'll be like a resurrection. A resurrection of the cause of Jesus Christ in spite of all of the efforts to destroy. Okay, let's continue to go forward. Now let me say, you don't have to agree with me on all this. And I wouldn't say boo at you if you didn't. But it makes sense. Like I say a lot of times in certain Revelation, that may not be it. I believe it is. That may not be it. But it sure fits what happened. It's historically accurate. Blessed and holy is he that hath part in the first resurrection. On such the second death hath no power, but they shall be priests of God and of Christ, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. All the blessings upon those that endure. The blessings upon those that though they be killed, they remain faithful. There will be the complete victory on their part. And they won't suffer second death, which we read further is being cast in the lake of fire and into the lake of brimstone. They won't suffer that. They'll be priests of God. They'll be with God. They'll be with Christ. See a picture of the victory here, folks? That part I don't see we can miss. Now notice. And when the 1,000 years are expired, that is when God has seen fit, and by His providence, seen fit that the early church would be completely preserved in that it would not be destroyed, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison. Now, I mentioned a few minutes ago, preventing Satan from destroying the early church did not totally restrict the influence and power of Satan. Even during the time of the early church, Satan was having a tremendous influence in drawing some people away from Christ, but not to its total destruction. There was Demas. There were others who forsook the Lord. And the book of Hebrews and the book of Galatians and the book of Romans was written to try to prevent apostasy. The devil would still have power, but not to the power that he could destroy it. He could hinder it, he could harm it, he could provoke it, but he could not destroy it. And so he would be, in this sense, loose. And he's loose now. He's not going to destroy the church of Christ. He may cause a lot of apostates, but he may cause a lot of digression. He may cause a lot of division and havoc and grief and pain and sorrow in the hearts of faithful brethren, but he will never destroy the Lord's church. And that means those in it won't be destroyed spiritually. That's the reason I and you want to stay in there with it, regardless of what comes. That's going to survive. That's going to persist. But he will be prevented from total destruction, but he will be loosed. And notice what he's going to do. and shall go out to deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, the number of whom is as the sand of the sea. Look at Gog and Magog, for therein is the key to the understanding of the figurative expression here. Gog and Magog in the Old Testament, in the book of Ezekiel, were names of the proponents of heathenism, enemies of God's people, servants of the devil, the very epitome and personification of that which was evil and wicked. And the devil will go out throughout all the world with this kind of influence and with this kind of battle to battle those who are of God. Notice, their number would be as the sands of the sea. How are you going to count those? World of iniquity, because there's a world of people who are following this world of iniquity. And they battle the way of the Lord. They are opposed to it. They're enemies of it. And they went up on the breadth of the earth and compassed the camp of the saints about, and the beloved city. What is the camp of the saints? Why, that's the Lord's church. Characterized here is that beloved city. The Lord's church, the camp of the saints, the beloved city would be besieged then, throughout the ages, and now by the forces of hell. You know, you don't even have to live very long to know that that's a reality even in our own day. And it will be all the days of time. But they'll never be victorious. They'll never destroy. They'll never stop it. And whosoever will may come, and they will be blessed eternally because of it. The forces of evil will go out and wage war against the Lord's church. And fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. That's what's going to be the ultimate of anybody that raises their hand against God and God's people. And the devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are, and shall be tormented day and night forever and forever. There's the ultimate destruction of the devil and those who side themselves with him. Presented to us in very highly symbolic, figurative language. Now the scene changes a little bit. And I saw a great white throne, and him that sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. Here's the white throne. That's been characteristic of the throne of God. And there were those who would see the face of the one on that throne, and they would, if they could, hide from it. But there's no hiding from God. There wasn't any place for them. There was no place for them to hide. You know, I try to visualize sometimes in my own mind in the day of judgment. And believe me, when I think about the day of judgment, I don't think so much about you. Not that I'm unconcerned, but I'll be there too. Will I rejoice, or will I try to find a place to hide? And if I have been in such a relationship with Almighty God that I would prefer on that day to hide, it'll be futile. It'll be useless. I can't hide. And this teaches us there is no hiding place. And I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God. Who are these dead? I want to present to you that two things about this passage that we're studying right now. Primarily, it refers to the judgment against the persecutors of the early church. Secondarily, and very applicable unto us, it is a picture of what it will be like at the ultimate judgment, because we will be at the ultimate judgment and they will be at the ultimate judgment. When it describes their judgment, it has to necessarily give us a picture of our own judgment. But in the context of things that were to shortly come to pass, this was primarily a judgment upon these that, in verse 5, the persecutors that were called the rest of the dead. I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God, and the books were opened. the book of the record of their life. And another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged out of those things which were written in the books according to their works. These persecutors would be judged. They would receive their just consequences and recompense. It would whatever results they had brought upon themselves, this is that by which they would be judged. And notice how complete it would be. The sea gave up the dead which were in it, and death and hell delivered up the dead which were in them, and they would judge every man according to their works. This had primary reference and warning and promise of the judgment of the persecutor. But wherein would we surmise for a moment the judgment of the persecutor is going to be any different, certainly in principle, from our own judgment? We too shall be judged according to the things that we have done in comparison to the things that we are instructed to do by God. This is the scene of the judgment of the wicked. And death and hell were cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. Whosoever was not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. You will recall back in the writings and the teachings of Christ and of others warning not to let your name be blotted out of the book of life. You know, it's pictured a lot of times, and maybe it's a little too simplistic and try to draw maybe a little bit too much literal. It's like God having I thought about that word this afternoon and it didn't stick with me. Like a register, list of words, catalog or something, and has the names of, this is the book of life, and has the names of those who are in it. Is your name written there? On the page bright and fair, in the book of thy kingdom, is thy name written there. Don't let your name be blotted out of the Lamb's book of life. That's God's register, if you please. Register on my word. I have another word. If you think of it, let me know. Roster. Boy, I don't know whether I want to be around her or not. She's psychic. But that's it. That's the word. And it started register, you see, that I was cool. Not close enough. But that's the idea. The idea is that God has on His roster the redeemed. And if your name is not in the redeemed, second death. That's all you got to look forward to. You better get your name on that roster. Okay. We're going to make it. At least through the 20th chapter. Does someone have some comments or questions? Yes, Jack. He's speaking of both. This was an occasion where a man was told to come and follow Christ, and he said, okay, but let me go first bury my father. I don't know whether the father was still living or whether the father had just died. It could well be that the father had just died, or it could be that it might have been some time before the father would die, and he wanted to stay with his father until he had fulfilled his responsibilities to the father. And Christ was emphasizing, your primary responsibility, if you follow me, is to me, not to your father. And those who are spiritually dead, let them bury the physical dead. You follow me. Both the physical and the spiritual dead are in that passage, I think. Anybody have a comment to help Jack out there and me too? Is that the idea? Brother Stiles? Don't you think that's about it? Thank you, sir. I said thank you before he opened his mouth. But I think that's the idea. It's prior. Who are you going to serve? To whom does your allegiance belong? Are you going to put your family before the Lord? And in this particular instance, this man had reluctance to follow him because of that. So in that particular passage, he's talking about the spiritually dead and the physical dead. You follow Christ. He's not forbidding us to bury our physical dead or to show proper respect. He is showing who your priorities and prime allegiance is to belong, and it is to Christ, even if someone else has to take care of those responsibilities. All right. In our last minute, chapter 21 is a picture of the victory of the Lord's church, because these last three and a half, four chapters, that's what the theme is. It's a victory celebration. And we have phraseology here in this, the meanings of which we can gather by looking to some of the Old Testament passages as well. But that's where we'll have to stop tonight.